everyone, and welcome to Minute 41 of Season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season is my good friend DJ Valentine of Simplistic Reviews. Welcome back to the show, DJ.
I would say I'm here as a pleasure, but I've been sent by Mr. Spielberg himself to make sure that this podcast is on the up and up and that you treat it with the complete respect that Mr. Spielberg deserves. I have documents here that you may need to sign afterwards, but yeah, it's fine.
Okay, that actually concerns me a little bit.
Don't worry.
That's because I know that Spielberg right doesn't like, I know that Spielberg doesn't like, doing discussions about his movies and stuff like that. You know, He doesn't do commentaries.
That's why I exist.
Okay. You're his mouthpiece.
Spielberg sits there and I stand behind him and I just yell angrily at the people who.
Okay.
I'm his bodyguard. I'm his intellectual bodyguard.
Okay. That's fair. I mean, that's one of the things that actually annoys me about watching Spielberg movies. Is, you know, that there are no commentaries.
Yeah. I used to buy all, I've seen every Spielberg movie, and I used to buy all the DVDs. DVDs, kids, were these things that you play movies on. And
circular discs.
Circular discs. They look like small little records. They never, when I saw they didn't have, because I used to buy them for the commentaries. I wanted to know as much information as possible.
Me too.
And you get a Spielberg, it's like you'll get the trailer. You get like a 2 minute featurette, and then you'll get like buy this at Universal, blah 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 blah, and that's it. There's nothing else. I got the D-Day anniversary version of this film for a DVD, and there's nothing on it. I think it has like a little thing about like Band of Brothers like thing, and that's it. There's no how did I do this? How did I do that? It's a mystery to me. It's like Premier League managers. They just keep injuries a secret to the public. It's like Steven Spielberg doesn't want anybody to know how the sausage is made. I don't know why he does that.
Yeah, I don't either. It like I said, I love Steven Spielberg. I've seen probably all of his movies.
Is it genius?
But this is something that baffles me. You know, that's what you want to. You know, you want to see Indiana Jones movies with commentaries. You want to see Jurassic Park with commentaries. I even want to see Schindler's List with a commentary.
I'll see Bridge of Spies with commentaries. Yeah. I'll see the Terminal with commentaries. I just want to know what goes on in that man's mind. I just want to. He's not the only one. I think Nolan's very cagey about that too, where they don't like doing commentaries. I'm like, bro, you guys are like legends. Let us pick your brain, man.
Well, maybe that's part of it. Maybe the whole idea is that they don't want us to be able to get into their mind.
Don't be selfish, Steven. Don't be selfish.
Okay, that's fair. What can I tell you? Okay, so minute 41 begins with Upham asking a question, and ends with the sky darkening as the on the troops that are walking along Omaha Beach. So, first of all, why don't you tell everyone what your background is with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? is it a movie you like? You know.
Okay. Here's the thing. Again, Spielberg is goated, as they say, the kids say. He's one of my, if he's not my favorite director of all time, he's at least top three. I saw this film. I was maybe in my late teens, early 20s. And as I rewatched it now in prep for the show, I realized how much I've stolen from Captain Miller. Not the movie, just the character. And I mean in terms of my attitude and especially in terms of leadership, because this movie essentially is a case of how to be a leader. Maybe not in my execution, but I've supervised and I've had to lead large groups of people. Nothing as dire and dangerous as war, but in film school and in real life and looking back, there are many things I just do that is totally Miller. Certain things I say almost verbatim that Miller says. This scene in particular is very, I think I might have done this yesterday. Where somebody, you know, a nervous person and you're trying to kind of, not put them at ease, but just calm down. follow me like that. I've done that many times. And I realize now it's probably from this movie. This film, I wouldn't say it's my favorite film of all time, but I do love it very much. And again, I think I've been on this show many times before, but we've done more, let's say, fun movies. But I have a list, because when I watch films, I'm kind of like, it's almost like a computer shuts down and absorbs information. I don't really like react. I kind of absorb it. But there are certain films that have made me cry. This is on top two of the movies that have literally got an emotional response from me. Most movies I'll laugh or, you know, chuckle to myself or whatever. But like to get DJ Valentine, yes, third person, to break down in a movie is... It kind of scarred me. Imagine your 19-year-old DJ Valentine. I'm sorry for you. And you're crying watching a war movie. It kind of caught me off guard. Like, what? So yeah, this movie has scarred me in a good way in terms of how much I love it. I love every bit of it. It's almost one of the things where I don't even like touching it. I don't like when we spoofed it. I was kind of like, well, I mean, I shouldn't. Because I love this movie so much, but I spoof things. I usually spoof movies I love, but this movie is it's so good. It's almost like wine. You just want to keep it on the counter and don't even like, it's so good. I don't like rewatching it a lot. Cause it's like, I want to save it for moments of my life to watch it. So there's movies like, are like cotton candy movies, like Avengers or like Fury Road. I watch it all the time, but certain movies are so good. You're like, okay, yeah, maybe if I'm feeling a certain way, I'll pop this on. That's Saving Private Ryan for me. It's one of those quintessential, is a word used way too often, but I would put it for this, quintessential war movies.
Okay, and what part of the movie makes you cry? I mean, does it make you cry every time?
I wanted to do, you didn't let me get.
Because you weren't quick on the draw.
I was slow. I was slow on the uptake. There's two scenes. There's the scene after the scene we spoofed for the show, the teacher scene, where he kind of goes away and he cries by himself. That got me. But it didn't get me. It was like, oh, what? Like I kind of felt it. And the scene, and it's weird, the scene where he's Tom Hanks is on the spoiler alert, he's at the tank and he's wounded and he's just shooting his gun at the tank. I burst out crying, and I didn't know why. I think it was the realization of what Spielberg was going to do, and I was like, no, he's not gonna spoiler alert, kill off Miller, he's not gonna do it. But when I saw him wounded, I'm like, he's not getting out of this, and he's still fighting, and it got me. I just, waterworks. I don't know what to this. Even talking about it, I get a little, you know, verklempt, as they say. I get a little thing in my chest. I don't know why. The part where he cries to get away from everybody is a kind of an expected cry moment, because and it's really good. Thanks, it's phenomenal. But that scene by him, just he's wounded, he's leaning into the thing, the tank is coming over, and he's shooting the tank, and then the planes come over and they bomb the tank. For some reason, before the planes show up, I'm just bawling. Crying like bad. And I don't know I've seen Amour, I've seen Fault in Our Stars, I've seen The Notebook, nothing. The Stone Face, Sphinx. That tank scene in Saving Private Ryan gets me every single time. I don't know why. Gets me every time.
All right, that's fair. I mean, it is an emotional movie. And now, you said this was number two on your list. Well, I know we're revealing too much about DJ Valentine here, but
you're breaking into my chocolatey center here. What's going on?
That's right. What's the number one
favorite movie of all time?
No, what's the number one movie that makes you cry? You said, you know.
Okay, this is kind of
we can skip this if you want.
No, it's fine. I'm an open book. No, it's, but the movies that make me cry are always weird. Like, you know, it's not like
Saving Private Ryan. Notebook.
Saving Private Ryan gets me. There's a scene, and this is a movie that people probably haven't even seen or don't. What, really? This movie called Moneyball with Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Brad. Yeah, baseball film about the Oakland A's. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big sports guy, but it's not the sport. Yeah, Billy Bean. It's not the sports that gets me. It's a very well done. I think Aaron Sorkin had something to do with it, I believe. And there's a scene where Brad Pitt takes his daughter to buy a guitar, and she starts singing to him, playing the, like trying out the guitar, and the guitar he gets her is the same guitar I got my baby sister, who I've essentially raised when she was younger. And she starts, and like the connection me and my sister have, we're 13 years apart, so it's like she's more like my daughter than my sister, even though she's like my best friend. So that part where she's singing the guitar hit the Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt's face where he's just like, he's just listening to her sing, and you can tell it's killing him. Not killing him in a bad way, just killing him in a, God, this is my child has grown past me. I've done something. I've created this. I made this. This is like my blood, flesh and blood, that look on Brad Pitt's face. And it just, I cry like a child. And I made my sister watch it. And she looks at me like, really? This is what, she doesn't give a crap. She's like, what, really? This is nothing. Well, why are you so emotionally? And I explain it to her. And I'm like, yeah, this and da, da, da. She's like, yeah, all right. Yeah, that's fine. That does not get her at all. But it gets me bawling tears. Because, I mean, I essentially raised her. So it was... It's kind of like a father, daughter, brother, sister kind of thing. And that Moneyball's right there. Yeah. And I saw that afterwards. So it was like, for a while, it was Saving Private Ryan. And then I saw Moneyball. And I was, and Moneyball, and it's that one scene, it's so isolated, it has nothing to do with anything else of the movie. It just comes out of nowhere and it just punched me in the feels. So yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing with that.
No problem. I mean, this is therapy for me.
I'm glad. I'm glad we're able to help with that. All right, what can I tell you? All right, so minute 41. So we ended things on Friday with Upham starting to ask a question to Miller. Miller shows up to pick up Upham, you know, because he needs his translator. Mm-hmm. His two guys were killed. And so we ended things on Friday with Upham starting to ask a question. He goes, may I bring my, and today we get the continuation of that. He walks over and he's carrying a typewriter and goes, typewriter, sir. And first of all, I mentioned this last week and a few weeks ago, you know, do you know, this is the second time in this movie where there's a typewriter, and, you know, Tom Hanks is this huge typewriter enthusiast.
Yeah, I do remember that. He's like a typewriter collector,
yeah.
Right?
He still types letters, you know, with a typewriter. He doesn't use a computer and stuff like that. You know, he's got like hundreds of typewriters in his house or something like that. Some crazy amount. Mm. You know, like he knows the difference.
I heard that on an interview with Jimmy Fallon or something. He was on some show talking about that. And I was like, oh, wow.
They have a documentary about typewriters where he is predominantly featured in it because they interview him about it. It's called, I think, California Typewriter Company or something like that.
Right.
I saw it a few years ago, and I was like, wow, Tom Hanks likes typewriters much?
How long has he been doing it? Was he doing it while this movie was made, or did he start it after the movie, or has he been doing it all his
life? Maybe he saw that Upham is leaving the typewriter and says, hey, I'm taking that back home.
You leave that there. When we say cut, I'm grabbing that typewriter.
That's right. Well, he might have said that. He could have said that if he was.
He might have provided the typewriter. He might have the set decorator might have been. I need an old time World War II typewriter. And Tom Hanks was like, "I've got just the thing."
Yeah, but
we get wagon and spin.
But he would let them drop it. I don't know.
Well, that's true. Yeah, then he would punch.
Punch Jeremy Davies.
Help him in the face.
Right, and you know the look on Miller's face is great. He's just like staring at him, and then
I love
he
it.
Just
I
love picks it. His hand up and shows him a pencil. He doesn't even,
the pragmatism is so
great, and it's wordless. He doesn't even need to say anything. Yep. He's basically just saying, "Use a pencil."
Yep. I've stolen so much from this character. I want to say this man, because Tom Hanks is not like Miller, but just the way that Miller operates is just very, it's like he could have been. He's so anti-captain in terms of, I mean, he's a genius, not to say genius, but he's very good in combat. But he's not like, he could have easily yelled at Upham. We're not taking the typewriter. Hold up a pencil. He doesn't even have to say it. It's so, he's just cut to the chase. Let's go. I'm not going to be mad at you. I understand why you're acting this way. Probably because he might have been that.
What we know about Miller, you know, he probably wasn't. He's a teacher. It's not like he's a career soldier or anything.
The teacher. Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of this first time in combat, maybe his first. I mean, we don't know how many missions. I don't know because Steven Spielberg won't tell me. I don't know how long Miller has been at war for. Do they specify this? Like,
no, it's not mentioned.
Right.
But in the script, they do. I mean, I'm not going through the script this season. Mm. But in the script, they mentioned that he's actually a Medal of Honor winner. Now, it's unclear as to whether he was awarded the Medal of Honor for what he did on D-Day or for something else.
Okay.
But I guess they realized that it was a little crazy to have it, so they just dropped it. You know, it's not mentioned in the movie at all.
Okay. All right.
We actually have a few things I'm going to touch upon the script this week, because there's stuff that does stand out. There's stuff that stands out and stuff that doesn't stand out, which. We'll get to.
Right.
So he's holding up a pencil. When do you think they first started manufacturing pencils?
Oh, jeez.
You know, people have been using graphite. For thousands of years, but mm-hmm. At a certain point, there were people who made pencils.
Manufactured pencils. You're saying not just use pencils. Yeah. Manufactured like an effect. God, I'm gonna say. It's late 1700s, 1800s maybe.
1662.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah, and I mean even Benjamin Franklin 100 years later.
Using quill pens in
That's right.
Right.
That's right. But Benjamin Franklin was advertising pencils in his Pennsylvania Gazette in 1729. And they even know that Washington used a pencil when he was surveying the Ohio country.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And they only started making them in America in 1812.
I was kind of right.
Yeah. And even Henry David Thoreau figured out how to make great pencils for him to start using it. Because the pencil factory in Concord, which in 1821 by a man named Charles Dunbar. So yeah, I mean it's been. And when do you think they added erasers to them?
Oh, that's a better question. Oh crap! It can't be that far away. Let's say the late 1800s.
Mid 1800s, 1858. Okay.
What were they doing before? Just scratching out?
I don't know. It's a very good question. So a man named Hyman Lippmann in 1858 got a patent for attaching an eraser to the end of a pencil. He ended up 4 years later selling it to a man named Joseph Reckendorfer for $100,000.
Reckendorfer. First off, awesome last name.
Yeah.
Awesome last name. I represent Mr. Reckendorfer.
Yeah. Exactly. And there actually was a court case between Reckendorfer against
Mr. Yeah,
exactly. Against a company called Faber-Castell, because he claims that they were infringing on his patent.
They're still around. I remember I've had a Faber pencil before.
It's very possible.
That's a company that makes. Are they still around?
Faber. No, but maybe you're thinking of Faber University. Wasn't that like in? Was that Revenge of the Nerds? No, Faber.
Maybe. That word I've heard before. Yeah. I could have swore I've seen it on a pencil before. So
maybe it was Greece. Was Faber in Greece? I don't know. Faber High School? Faber College? No, I remember Faber College. Oh, maybe it's Animal House. Is it?
Maybe it's Animal House. Maybe it's Animal House. Am I Jim Belushi?
Is it possible that that's Faber College? Know. Animal House. Yes, Faber College. There you go. All right. I was
Look at that poll.
There we go. Exactly. And the Corkys actually even reached the Supreme Court in 1875.
Faber-Castell pencils still around, by the way.
All right, very nice. And well, that's because they won the Corkys.
They won. We're gonna make it forever. We're forever
The
dead.
question is Reckendorfer still around?
Reckendorfer, yeah. He Reckendorfer's a recluse. He's a the Reckendorfer family. They've moved on to other things. Meats, I think.
Apparently.
I'm making up history.
So there we go. Now we know why Miller is suggesting that Upham use a pencil. Because they haven't had erasers for 100 years. So actually there is no eraser on the pencil that he gives him. So
Yeah, it's like
he's
a
like,
the
that's right.
drafting
If you
pencil, it's
make
like.
mistakes, you're screwed. So basically, Upham then realizes that okay, that's a good idea. He puts the typewriter back on the shelf, and then grabs a helmet and runs over to Miller, who is just smirking at him as he's coming along. And at this point, Upham takes the pencil, and Miller looks down and sees that he's holding a German helmet in his hand. And he goes, "That is souvenir." And he goes, "No, sir." And then Upham runs back to go switch it, and he goes, "Take your time, Corporal."
That is a line I've said to many of staff member that works under me who's been
Take your time,
nervous
Corporal,
or
or
doing
take your
something
time.
like not corp doesn't take it. I've delivered that like that many times to like somebody like rushing to get to catch up to me or get ready to move out with me or whatever, and I just take your time. It's okay. It's fine. He's very he's not he a regular captain wouldn't do that. Think of every military movie you've ever seen. That captain's yelling or he's talk doing a lot of Tom Hanks's Miller is very. It's subversive, I guess, what you would say to a military leader, to one of the best leaders we're gonna see. He's so kind, and it leads into what he was before, which was, yeah. So you're wondering, like, I've you watch this and compare it to like The Dirty Dozen or something like that, and you're like, or Kelly's Heroes or something. It's not the same. He's very personable and nice. But not nice in a way where he's weak. Just that the way he says "Take your time, Corporal." It's funny, but it's also like, huh, this guy. I kind of like this. He's not taking himself too seriously. He's not getting up. And I don't. We've probably not talked about this yet, but I want to underline this point because I've seen this movie. I don't like Upham, and I never will. This is the
I don't think
character
we're
that I
supposed
guess
to
this is the
like
first
him,
time
are
we've
we?
seen.
Or
We're not like see. I thought that they're making this scene happen because they want you to like this character, and the events of this character make me despise this character. So it's like the opposite of what I thought there the intention was. So every time I see Upham, it gets me fucking Upham. I just growl. I don't like him
I
at all.
believe that that's part of it. We're really not supposed to like him.
If that's the intention, it's brilliant. If it's the if it, 'cause in every other aspect of this, you would think he's supposed to be the audience's, the character, the character the audience looks through, but I don't identify with him whatsoever. So he does certain things later on in this film that I won't get to talk about that I despise and I will never like him for. So I kind of like every time I see him when I'm watching this scene again. In the beginning, I was like, and near the end, I was like, "It's got you don't get no forgiveness from me, man." I'm
Right.
sorry.
Okay. That, I mean that's fair. That's definitely fair. Now, and for me, whenever I see this, it reminds me of like Return of the Jedi, where you see the Ewoks, playing music at the end on helmets.
On the helmets with the shelf with the helmets falling. Yeah.
It's also because they like my question is okay, why is there a German helmet on their you know, on the shelf.
Well, somebody must have taken it as a souvenir. I mean, they were taking souvenirs of other things earlier in the movie. So yeah, it may not be his souvenir, but
right.
Somebody
but I would look at it from the perspective of, if someone's taking a souvenir like that, you put it in a bag. You wouldn't leave it out for anyone to, you know, to see and I guess complain about. You know, you can get in trouble for, you know, for looting or whatever you want to call it.
I see. Here's the thing about the way this, and we're going to see, we're going to talk about a shot a couple seconds from now, but I think as regimented as the United States military was during D-Day, I think because of the chaos of it, a lot of that stuff went under the, like, turned a blind eye to the looting and the, I mean, I didn't get to talk about the D-Day, the Omaha Beach scene where the guys are surrendering and they're just blowing them away,
right?
Not hiding the fact they're blowing them away. So I think a lot of that stuff, taking souvenirs, taking loot, shooting unarmed prisoners, because it's Omaha Beach was such a chaotic cluster F of a battle. A lot of that, they got to prioritize what they run. They find important in a helmet from a Nazi soldier. Right. They practice, okay. Whatever, whatever, man. I'm just happy I made it on the right. Beach.
Okay, I mean, that's fair. Saying. I mean, anyone who's seen Band of Brothers or The Pacific, I mean, they show that's the stuff that was going on, you know, and nobody was upset about it. You know, it's, you know, I want souvenirs. I mean, you can even go all the way back to a movie from 1946. If you're talking about the best years of our lives, you know, where you see one of the characters come home and he's got a sword and a flag that he took off of a dead Japanese soldier. You know, it's like,
right.
So,
I mean, Mellish takes the Hitler army knife, the Hitler youth knife or whatever. So and that's before this. So it's just establishing. I think the Omaha Beach scene, the pretty much once they get the military takes advantage and is showing how not callous, but jacked in terms of, yeah, we'll shoot the unarmed prisoner. Yeah, we'll take this knife. We'll salute the. It's not like somebody looking at, what are you doing? It's nothing like that. It's literally survival. We survived spoils of war situation. A lot of when Dennis Farina is there, it just doesn't seem like it's something they would care about. They should. You're right. The military rules dictate not to do a lot of that stuff, but I think Spielberg is showing it because,
right?
Yeah, you're not supposed to do it, and they were doing it anyway. Because it was none of these men have experienced anything like that before in their lives, and they're not going to
begrudge the rules at that point. Do you think that Miller is somebody who would be disturbed by the fact that this is what his men are doing? Because he doesn't seem like a looter.
No, I think Miller is on a track of him. I don't say it's selfish to say him. He's only thinking about getting home to his wife. But in terms of he's going to do his duty and he knows people are bending the rules and he's not going to cause any situation he doesn't have to that will prevent or delay him getting home, which is what makes the sacrifice later in the movie mean more, because I think he was all about the Nazi scene where he's letting the Nazi go, he's following that rule, but he's trying to balance humanity and his selfish desire to get home. I think the whole movie, and it kind of where it'd be easy to just like, well, Ryan's dead or Ryan didn't want to come back with us, let me go home. But and he sacrifices that to do the right thing at the end because at the beginning, I don't care about that. He's balancing. He's going back and forth to me. I'm not sure he's like strict. We're gonna follow every single. He's not like that. He's not. To me, in my mind, in my head canon, Miller just, I gotta get home to my wife. If I have to do a court martial, then that's gonna delay me another 6 months. And I gotta. So it's like a stuff. Miller's doing stuff is not what he's really caring
about. Okay, I think that's fair. I mean, we did talk about some of the other looting that was going on and taking body parts and all that stuff. That was just like. You know,
right.
And it's stuff that happened in the background. It's not even like going on in front of us.
Right, right, right.
Right. So basically, at this point, Miller's just being patient, waiting for Upham to be ready. He sort of like Miller smirks as he's basically saying to him, "Take your time." And this map that we saw on Friday that he was preparing, he's putting it in his pouch, getting ready to go. Upham runs back to grab a helmet, the right helmet this time. Miller gets ready to walk with him. Miller puts on his helmet, and then he looks over at Upham, who's carrying his duffel bag and what looks like another typewriter, but I don't know what could be in that satchel that he's
Back,
got there. It really does look like he told him you don't need to bring a typewriter, but he's still bringing it. It's not the same one because look at the shape of that. The shape of that bag is just very strange. So whatever, maybe it's his spare typewriter. He's like, I got to get this back to Tom Hanks.
He's like, look, you're going to carry that with you and you're not going to drop it because I'm Tom Hanks. I know I'm Captain Miller, but I'm also Tom Hanks. So do not
That's
drop a
right.
typewriter.
And then, I mean, again, if it's a typewriter, Tom Hanks or Miller throws it and it lands on the ground. So, that was one that doesn't work. It already wasn't working. So who cares? And as they're walking out of this area, you can see there's a huge box of Camel cigarettes. That's just like sitting on top of a different box. It's just very interesting. You see, if you see at second 26, one of the other map guys is looking over as Miller's throwing the stuff on the ground, and then you can see an upside down I guess package, this or a huge box that says on the Camel on it. So I guess
Camel cigarettes is the military's cigarette of choice, I guess.
well, apparently for these guys it was. Do you know what year they started Camel cigarettes?
Oh man, that's a great question. I'm gonna say 29.
Very close, very close. It goes back to 1913.
Oh wow. That's
Yeah,
a lot
very
older
close.
than I thought. That's a lot older than I thought.
That's right. Do you know
He's
the name of
carrying
the
a
company?
briefcase. Oh no. See, I'm looking at the scene right now to see what that bag is he's carrying. I don't know what that is. I don't know what it
But it can conceivably be another typewriter,
is.
couldn't it?
Probably. I'm like, what is that?
Right. So, do you know the name of the company that produced and still produces Camel cigarettes?
I'm assuming Philip Morris, but I could be wrong.
No, it's R.J. Reynolds,
RJ Ren, okay.
Richard Joshua Reynolds. Which it's amazing that even after 110 years, he's still, within. I mean, he just. It's just amazing what he did. He innovated the idea of having packaged cigarettes. Because up until then, people had to just roll their own cigarettes all the time.
Right.
And within the first year, he was able to sell 425 million packs of cigarettes. And seriously.
Jeez. My God. This is before when people thought cigarettes were like healthy. They're good for you.
Yeah. Well, that was back then, of course.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So yeah, and obviously their advertisement is always having a camel on them. Some of them animated, some of them at the beginning they just look like camels.
Right, and they got a made a character. He made a Chester Cheetah out of one of the camels, and he's like
That's right.
a friendly mascot of poison and cancer, friendly cancer mascot.
Yeah, well, wasn't he called Old Joe or something like that? What was his name?
I think so.
Yeah, because their
That
slogan
sounds
was
very familiar.
I'd walk a mile for a camel.
I mean, even the slogan is silly. Looking back at it now, back then it was probably like, oh, it's brilliant. Some Mad Men character was probably like, that's a brilliant idea. But it's just like, man, you made a friendly, essentially Tony the Tiger, but for cigarettes. You essentially made that.
Exactly. You know, well, one thing I couldn't figure out was just why they called them camels. Like, what was the...
I think it's the color of the
filter, No. It's because it's because he used Turkish tobacco.
Oh, okay.
Which was imitations of Egyptian cigarettes. So, you know, therefore he decided, you know, Egypt camels, you know, Africa. I don't know.
I don't smoke, so I'm gonna just defer to the flavor and taste of this, and the difference between Turkish and Egyptian cigarettes. I would assume Egyptian is better because I'm comparing it to cotton. So I have no idea.
Well, apparently in 1913 it was, but camel cigarettes were cheaper, and that's why they outdid them.
Oh, well, I'll do it. I'll do it every time.
Exactly. And then basically as they're working out, so Miller says, for one thing, you don't need to carry those. And then, you know, as the things are falling, so his helmet also falls again. And then he goes, you'll need that. And he goes, yeah, I'll need that, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then the two of them walk out of this area, up and walking very strangely. And then basically the second half of this minute is just soldiers and trucks passing by as they give us a shot of the whole area here, you know, Omaha Beach and occupation, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, did you notice that as they're doing a pan, there is a Jeep that drives by carrying the men?
Yeah, I did. It's just the first clue to the unit or whatnot. The first time when in the theater, I did not. But like over years of me watching the movie, I was like, oh, right.
Right. I'll explain tomorrow about that because that's, you know, I have more information about that for tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Because it's just very strange that we see them leaving here in a Jeep. And then they give us an amazing shot of Omaha Beach. You know, where you see, you know, you still see all of the Czech hedgehogs, and you see the Higgins boats, and you see an ambulance and soldiers marching along and stuff like that. As you said, this is occupation. You know, you can see that the fighting is completely over. There are all these balloons around, you know, weather balloons and blimps and all things.
And no bodies.
And that's right.
They got rid of all the
bodies. But again, there is an ambulance there. So the question is whether that ambulance is maybe trying to pick up something or whatever. Mm-hmm. But again, this is 3 days later.
Right.
So
it's just there was mountains of bodies here. And it's like, it's almost like it. First time that I got to go. Because the scene in the beginning it's one of the most intense cinema scenes of all time. So it's like the first, when you see the aftermath of it, it's like, wow. And look at the scope of, look at what they had to cross. And now, you know, just like it's routine. They're just routinely moving in now. But 5 minutes earlier, it was
completely
literally
as we discussed in detail over the last 8 weeks. So yes. Very true. You know, after this panning shot finishes, we get basically a second, and we get to see what looks like an overcast field. You know, the weather is overcast, it's cloudy, it's a little dark, maybe dusk, something like that. But we're gonna have to wait until tomorrow to find out specifically what it is that we get to see there. Did you have anything else you want to say about today's minute?
I wonder how much, again, because Steven Spielberg won't tell us. Like, I would love to see the making of that shot. Because I know it's a lot of CG of 1998 CG, which again still really holds up. But like the way he made that shot, I would like to see an intricate detail how he did that, because it's so, it kind of takes your breath away, that shot, and it kind of puts you right in that moment of, wow, they're here. It's one of the better shots in the movie where, and it's most of it, I would assume, again, because he won't tell me, it, a lot of it is a CG shot, but it's really, really good, really well done. And it kind of makes Tom Hanks and Davies kind of like ants in this gigantic
military machine. I do have an interview scheduled in for a future episode with one of the guys who worked at ILM. And I think he mentioned to me in passing that he worked on this scene. So it would be cool to hear what he has to say. You know, that would be really cool.
Oh, great. I'll check that out.
Yeah. So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams movie soundtracks, themes, however you want to look at it. What do you have on your top five? Start with your number five and work your way up, DJ.
This was hard from the bottom up. I already knew my first two, but the other three I was kind of like, you asked me on a Tuesday, which is today as recording this.
No, today's a Monday.
Monday. Wait. Sorry, I don't know. Yeah, how much? I don't know. if you asked me, it might change. But the three in the bottom are going to change.
Meaning, if I would have asked you 6 weeks ago, it would have been a Tuesday. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly. Well, okay. where am I? Who are you? So I kind of picked the ones, and these themes are the ones that kind of, not personal to me, like I cherish them, but it's just more like it gets me going. And John Williams, again, goated. He's the greatest composer of all time. Don't at me. Don't question me. There's nobody comes close. The man has a gajillion Oscars. So my number five, I'll go 5-1. I got to go Superman theme here. And I know a lot of people probably have this higher. Superman theme.
Nobody has it higher than you. One person has it. Well, obviously, one person has it one slot above yours.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I think it drops a little bit lower for me because a lot of these themes can't be equaled. And the fact that Hans Zimmer made a Man of Steel theme that I think is not as better, but I love almost as much as this theme, kind of drops it because it's not as, like, untouchable. It's the Superman theme. You know the Superman theme. You can play it. They play it in sports arenas. It's so freaking recognizable. But you know, I like it a lot. It's essentially the what do they call it in an opera where they play it for the movie? Play before the opera gets going. The overture. It's kind of the overture for the original Superman theme. So yeah, for Superman movie. Sorry. So yeah, Superman theme is my number five. My number four. Is probably the only thing good to come out of these movies, which is Duel of the Fates. Because I do not like The Phantom Menace. I really hate the Attack of the Clones movie. And Revenge of the Sith is just okay for me. But Duel of the Fates is amazing. And it's so good. They've used it. They use it in Phantom Menace. They use it in Revenge of the Sith. They use it in the Clone Wars series. It is as iconic a Star Wars theme, and it came way later than the other three. So for him to go back to the well in a franchise that he already worked on and come up with something as iconic as maybe a song I use later is fantastic. Duel of Fates, everybody,
yeah,
it sparks so many meme. It's fantastic. Jurassic Park, welcome to Jurassic Park theme. I did a sketch for our show when I was going through some of the music, and the build of just one piano to where it leads to is so again, it's the theme, but it starts with just one piano and it repeats, but it keeps building and building and building into the what you get. It's phenomenal. Jurassic Park. And I know Jake Clewitt probably has a number one, but whatever.
What a surprise.
What a surprise. Yes, I know. Number two, Imperial March. And most Imperial, I would say Asteroid Belt, because Imperial March is kind of bleeded in there together. It's from The Empire Strikes Back when the Millennium Falcon is escaping the Star Destroyer and it flies through the Asteroid Belt trying to escape the TIE fighters. And it has the Imperial March in it in the beginning. And then it goes into this. It gets crazy. It's fantastic. And it's the Millennium Falcon, the greatest cinema ship of all time, doing crazy acrobatics, and you know, so it kind of gets me going. And you got, you know, Han just locked in. It just gets if this pulls me in. And this is an easy one, number one, for me, because Raiders, the Raiders March is fantastic. But for me, it's my number one, but it's specifically not the parts that people really think it is. My part that gets me going every single time, when I was pretending to be Indiana Jones as a five-year-old boy running around my living room pretending I was jumping from truck to truck, it's the build-up part in the song. There's a part that part. I love it. I think they do it in Raiders when he's fighting the big Nazi by the plane. I think they do it when he's making his way in. They even use it in the horrible Dial Destiny movie. But yeah, the build-up part to me in Raiders March is phenomenal. I love it, and the whole song is phenomenal. But just that part of it gets me. When I get it just gets me amped. So yeah, the build-up part in the Raiders March is fantastic.
Very cool. All right, thank you very much for that list, DJ. Do you want to tell people where they can find DJ Valentine?
You can find me on a little show called the Something Reviews podcast with my co-hosts Matthew Stewart and Justin Palizzi. Every 1st, 15th, and 20th of the month, we do a regular show on the 1st, a mini show on the 15th, and a movie commentary. Not as good as this one, usually. We make fun of on the 20th. So yeah, check us out there. Simplistic.reviews or search Simplistic Reviews on YouTube. Tune in, iTunes, whatever those things are called. I can't remember the names.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find my website, movieroundminute.com, or you can shoot me an email to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.
Of days gone by.